America's great experiment of democracy is in trouble. Donald Trump's big lie that he won the 2020 election is not just accepted, but widely promoted by a Republican Party that supports state laws making it harder for some people to vote. Some liberal Democrats take comfort in the country's increasing diversity, but Yascha Mounk has a warning. He says it's diversity that's threatening democracy, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere in the world, in nations increasingly divided by class and race and religion. We'll hear his warning about the danger of believing that demography is destiny. But first, to Vladimir Putin's defiance of the rules of war and the inability of the United Nations to influence Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine. When it was founded in San Francisco in 1945, the promise of the UN was the peaceful resolution of international disputes. But now Putin is threatening nuclear warfare against the U.S. and NATO. And when U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres paid a visit, Russia dropped bombs on Kyiv, Ukraine's capital city. Just a few days before that, I spoke with a former ambassador to Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer. He's now a senior fellow at the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Institute and a William Perry Fellow at Stanford University. I asked him if the UN might play a role or if it's essentially out of the peacekeeping business. His answers were prophetic. Let's get a little background before we begin. As the war in Ukraine continues, the U.S. is contributing many billions of dollars in weapons and military equipment. America's Secretary of State and Defense, Antony Blinken, and Lloyd Austin, after a risky visit to Kyiv, said that this country wants Russia to be weakened. Russia's top diplomat, Sergei Lavrov, says the U.S. and NATO are risking nuclear war, and Vladimir Putin has often enough warned about his nuclear weapons. He's even fired off a new ICBM. So where is the United Nations, established in 1945 with the goal of providing peace in our time? Stephen Pfeiffer is a senior fellow at the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Institute, the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence, and he's also the William Perry Fellow at Stanford University. Most importantly for this conversation, he is a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Mr. Ambassador, welcome aboard.
Thank you for having me.
After the Russian diplomat, Mr. Lavrov, met with the U.N. Security General, Secretary General Guterres, he said that the West is flaunting U.N. Principles. I think the same thing happens. Wait a minute. I'm sorry. I'm getting a little mixed up here because I think Guterres is meeting with the leaders today. Let me just put it this way. The leaders of Russia and Ukraine are saying that, accusing each other of violating the principles of the UN. What do you think is the role that the UN might play at this time, or is it just out of business?
Well, let me first say that it is Russia that chose a war of choice that invaded Ukraine without justification and without provocation. The UN might be able to play a role, but my expectations for the Secretary General's visit to Moscow are pretty limited, because thus far, over the last 9 weeks of war, you have seen no real indication that the Russians are prepared for a serious negotiation. They continue to put forward maximalist demands, and by all appearances, Vladimir Putin wants to decide this issue on the battlefield.
Well, what about the UN? When it was originally established, and often since, it has been claimed, at least, that it should have the ability to move in, whether it involves getting the countries to agree to have troops or in some other way, get involved in maintaining the peace.
Well, I think we're seeing one of the limitations of the UN, which is the real authority on questions, for example, regarding peacekeeping and such, lies not with the General Assembly, but with the UN Security Council. And where in this case, Russia, as a member of the Security Council, it has a veto right. It can basically veto and block any decisions by the UN Security Council to try to resolve the conflict. And you've already seen that Russians exercise that veto, even to veto resolutions that would have criticized Russia for launching the war in the first place. Now, when there's agreement among the permanent five, the five countries that have the veto right, that's the United States, Russia, Britain, France, and China, the Security Council can work. But when one country has an interest, and we've seen the Russians, of course, now have very much have an interest here, they can use their veto to block the work, just as the Russians use their veto to block any criticism by the Security Council of Syria over the last 7 years.
What about the idea of having the General Assembly debate a matter that has been vetoed, with the idea, obviously, of trying to influence whoever it is that does the veto?
Well, the UN General Assembly, I believe, has now voted twice on issues that were not making progress in the Security Council. The General Assembly condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and the General Assembly also voted to suspend Russian membership on the UN Human Rights Commission. But again, I don't think the General Assembly has the authority to sort of force a Security Council decision or to force a peacekeeping presence. And remember, even under the best of circumstances, the UN is not going to send any kind of a peacekeeping force into a conflict until there is a ceasefire that both sides have made clear they want that peacekeeping force. And again, it's very clear that the Russians are trying to prosecute this war and win it on the battlefield, although fortunately the Ukrainians have been very effective in defending themselves.
So is the UN then a sort of paper tiger unless one or another of the combative parties decides to make peace?
I think, yeah, until both sides, and I believe that President Zelensky, we've seen from him offers over the last 7 weeks that I believe are an effort by the Ukrainians to try to find a compromise, because I think Zelensky wants to stop the war, but he's not met with any kind of reciprocal readiness to engage in a serious way from the Russians. Now, if the Russians were prepared to engage, there might be a role for the UN or somebody to help mediate the differences. But again, and for the last 9 weeks, we've seen no seriousness on the Russians' part to have a real negotiation.
Zelensky has called for having peacekeepers in Mariupol, the city that is so terribly devastated by Russian attacks. Any chance of that?
I think Mariupol, it's hard to see that again, because the Russians would have to agree to that. Mariupol is a tragic scene. Much of the city has been leveled by the Russian attack, and it's truly ironic. These are Russian forces besieging a Ukrainian city where more than 90% of the population speak Russian as their first language, and almost half the population is ethnic Russian. But there's no sign that the Russians, again, want to have some kind of a settlement there. Their goal appears to be to occupy the city, there's no sign that they would welcome any kind of UN presence.
So the UN then seems to have something of a lesser role than keeping the peace, which was the hope in 1945 when it was established in San Francisco. What is its role, and what's useful about it?
Well, again, I think the UN, sometimes people overlook that there's a lot of international organizations that are run by the UN, for example, the World Health Organization, that do mundane things that are actually very important to countries around the world. And again, when there is agreement among the five members of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, the UN can authorize peacekeeping forces. It can take actions. And you saw this, for example, back in 1990, 1991, during the first Gulf War, where there was UN Security Council resolutions authorizing the use of force to push the Iraqis out of Kuwait. So again, when there's a circumstance where the interests of the five permanent members are aligned in an agreement, the UN Security Council can be effective. But when it involves one of the members or a client of one of the members, the Security Council may not be able to act.
Let me ask you a little bit about Ukraine. Since you were ambassador, it seems to me it has changed a lot. Does that seem to be the case to you? You were there at what point?
I served there in the late 1990s, and I think there have been some significant changes in Ukraine over the past 22 years. One is, and I go back to a Ukrainian friend who told me, in 2014, after the Russians used military force to seize Crimea, and then Russian military got involved in a conflict in Donbas in eastern Ukraine, a conflict which had killed 14,000 people before the Russian invasion on February 24 of this year. And this Ukrainian friend said to me, you know, he said, Vladimir Putin has succeeded where centuries of Ukrainian nationalists have failed. Putin has created a national identity in Ukraine, and he's forged that identity, and he's imbued it with a strong anti-Russian sentiment. And that's even more true today. I think the Russians have hugely miscalculated. The Russian military and the Kremlin apparently expected that the Ukrainians would not fight. It's astonishing that they thought that. Any Western expert would have told them that the Ukrainians would fight. And what you've seen, I believe, among the Ukrainian public is a hardening of attitudes. They look at the war crimes, the indiscriminate shelling of civilian structures in Mariupol. They look at the atrocities that were committed in places like Bucha near Kyiv. And that's only hardening their attitude and their determination to resist the Russians. And I believe for many Ukrainians, they see this as an existential fight. They believe that if they lose this, they lose their democracy, and they lose the vision which many Ukrainians hold, which is becoming a normal European state.
Is it a good idea for America's top officials, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, to say that it's time for Russia to be weakened? Doesn't that sort of lead into Vladimir Putin's apparent sense that there is a conspiracy to go on to overtake Russia?
Well, again, let's remember that the United States and NATO and other countries are helping the Ukrainians because the Ukrainians are exercising their right under the UN security, under the UN charter, to self-defense. It was the Russians who invaded Ukraine on February 24 with no provocation. And so I think what Secretary Austin was expressing the desire is to weaken the Russian military to the point where the Russians will end this war and either withdraw or engage in a negotiation that would be a serious attempt and where Ukraine could have a chance of securing a settlement that would meet Ukrainian interests.
How concerned are you about escalation to the point that Putin might, in fact, use a nuclear weapon?
Well, there are mixed signals coming out of Moscow. And let's be clear, the only ones who are raising nuclear threats are Russian officials. Today, we saw Sergei Lavrov say the nuclear threat was real. It's curious because last week he said Russia won't use nuclear weapons. And his foreign ministry spokesperson, she said that suggestions that Russia was considering using nuclear weapons were, quote, fake news, unquote. So the Russians are sending very mixed signals here. It concerns me a bit. I mean, we should be worried when senior officials in a nuclear-armed state talk about use of nuclear weapons. But I think we should also understand that for Russia and Russian officials, there's a tendency to bluster about nuclear weapons. And part of this is Moscow's self-image. Russia wants to see itself as a great power in world politics. And Russia's claim to being a great power, though, depends in large part on the fact that they have a lot of nuclear weapons. So they tend to talk pretty loosely about nuclear weapons, more so than other nuclear weapon states do. And again, a part of this is to try to intimidate the West. So I'm a bit concerned, but I also think it's important that we not be intimidated, that we understand that part of this is really part of a Russian psychological warfare against the West.
What about the Russian people? We hear that they are, of course, bombarded by propaganda by the Putin regime. And yet at the same time, there are indications that there are people within Russia who are opposed to what Russia is doing. It's a huge country. It's very diverse. Do you have any idea or way of summarizing how you think Russians feel in general at this point about Vladimir Putin?
Well, the first point to make is that the Kremlin has very tight control over the information space, particularly television and main newspapers in Russia. And so the Russian population is getting a very contrived picture of what's going on in Ukraine. And polls show that a large portion of Russians support Vladimir Putin and support the war. Now, when they ask more sophisticated polls, the numbers supporting the war seem to drop. And my guess is, as this war drags on, as the economic sanctions begin to take effect and Russians see inflation accelerate into double digits, they begin to see more factory closures as those factories can no longer get Western inputs, and they begin to see the Russian economy contract. The World Bank expects Russia's economy to contract by 11% this year, and senior Russians, head of the Moscow exchange expects it to contract by about 10%. And as they see that, And as the news of Russian casualties continues to come home, that may erode the support for the war.
I get the impression that if you tell a pollster that you don't like the war, you have the chance of being turned in.
Yeah, it's one of those questions. If you get a call on the phone asking your view in Russia, and you ask, do you support Putin in the war, you've got a bias towards saying yes. But for example, a more sophisticated poll, I saw the results where they gave a group of Russians three questions. Do you like this? Do you like this? Do you like the things that were, you know, do you support a growing economy? Things like that. They gave another group of Russian four questions. And the fourth question was, do you support the war in Ukraine? And then they asked the Russians, don't tell us which one of those you support, but how many of those items do you support? And in the group with three, pretty much everybody supported three. In the group with four, pretty much everybody supported just three. And so I think we can surmise which one they didn't support. That was a poll that allowed people to express their opposition or their lack of support for the war without signaling that out in a way that would be safe for pollsters. And those more sophisticated polls seem to show that while the Russian population supports Putin in the war, it's much lower than the 70 or 80% that we see in other polls.
What about the extraordinary brutality that we have seen, not just in terms of shelling and destroying entire cities, but, of course, the personal torturing of victims, tying them behind with their hands behind their backs, and all of the atrocities that we saw in Bucha. Is that typical of Russia when it engages in warfare?
Unfortunately, I think we have to say yes. I mean, because the sorts of atrocities and the indiscriminate shellings, you know, they're not isolated incidences. You have indiscriminate attacks on Kharkiv, on Chernihiv before the Russians withdrew, other cities, and the Ukrainians are reporting other sites where they see atrocities as in Bucha. And if you go back and look at historically, look at how the Russian military leveled Aleppo in Syria, or go back 20 years ago to the Second Chechen War, where the Russian military basically leveled Grozny and probably killed 10% of the population in the process. And I think this is, though, it's a miscalculation by the Russians. The Russians seem to think that this kind of, these atrocities may somehow terrorize the population and undermine the public spirit, the public morale. But my guess is it's having the opposite effect, is it's hardening the determination of the Ukrainians to push back, to fight and defend themselves. So again, this may be another one in a long line of miscalculations being made by the Kremlin in this disastrous war.
Back to the beginning of our conversation, is there any opening, do you think, at this point for the United Nations, or do we just have to wait until Russia is willing to start talking about a ceasefire?
Sadly, I don't think the United Nations can have any impact until the Russians are prepared to change course. And everything we've seen for the last weeks is that Putin, although he failed, the Russian military failed in its effort to capture Kyiv, it clearly does not have the capability to take the eastern two-thirds of Ukraine as its initial invasion routes suggested. But he still hopes to win something now in Donbas and eastern Ukraine. And until the Russians recognize, and until the Ukrainians are able to demonstrate that the Russians cannot achieve those goals on the battlefield, I think the chances for a serious negotiation in which the Russians are prepared to reach some compromises are very low.
And we hear a lot of talk about war crimes. Neither Russia nor the United States is a member of the International Criminal Court. Would it appear that a war crimes trial is even possible under those circumstances?
It may be difficult because my guess is those who would be charged with the crimes, and it looks like both the Ukrainians, but also with the help of the International Criminal Court and some other countries, are doing some pretty serious investigations. And I think the Ukrainians believe they can actually identify, for example, individual Russian soldiers who were in Bucha when the atrocities were committed. But if those Russians remain in Russia, it's hard to see how the International Criminal Court will be able to establish any jurisdiction over them. Now, could there be a trial in absentia? I don't know. But my guess is those who've committed war crimes in the Russian military, and certainly in the senior Russian leadership, those who've authorized this war of choice, as long as they stay in Russia, are likely going to be able to avoid being held accountable for what they've done.
All right, a lot to talk about and a lot to look forward to. Stephen Pfeiffer again with the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Institute, William Perry Fellow at Stanford University, and former ambassador to Ukraine. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
The U.S. is politically divided. On one side are those who believe Donald Trump's big lie. On the other, those making the case for liberal values and our electoral system. But this isn't the only place where democracy itself is in trouble. Back in a moment with the much admired political thinker Yascha Mounk on To the Point.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Democracy is in trouble all over the world, from Brazil to Hungary to the United States. Yascha Mounk, the much-admired scholar and writer, says the problem is increased diversity. That may be inevitable, but it's no reason to be pessimistic, he explains. In a book called The Great Experiment, Why Diverse Democracies Fall Apart and How They Can Endure, Mounk is a professor of the practice of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University. He's founder of the digital magazine Persuasion, contributing editor at The Atlantic, and senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yascha Mounk, welcome to The Point.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I think the key word in your title is diverse. So explain, if you will, how increased diversity threatens democracy.
Yeah, so, you know, we're really trying to do something historically unprecedented at the moment. There are lots of democracies which were founded at a time when we were relatively homogeneous, like Germany, the country I grew up in, which built its successful democracy after the terrible expulsions and genocides of the first half of the 20th century, when the country was more homogeneous than it had been at any point. And then there's lots of democracies that have always been very diverse, but which made that work by allowing one group to subjugate and dominate others in a terrible way, like the United States at the time of its founding. What's really new now is to have deeply diverse democracies which try to treat all of their members as equals. And so the point of my book is to try to think about how that can work. Now, as you're pointing out, that is actually very difficult, because when you look at history, some of the worst examples of civil war, of genocide, of deep conflict was between different ethnic and religious groups. And whereas you might think the democratic institutions make it easier to deal with that kind of diversity, history seems to suggest that that's not the case. Many of the most famous democracies in the history of the world, from ancient Athens to the city-states of medieval Italy, were ethnically exclusionary. And many of the most tolerant diverse societies in the history of the world, from Baghdad in the 9th century to Vienna in the 19th century, were actually monarchies or empires. And there's a reason for that. Because in a monarchy, I might not have any power and you might not have any power. So there's more people immigrating into your group, or if you have more children, that doesn't really worry me. In a democracy, which is always a search for majorities, if you have more kids, if there's more immigrants from your group, I might start to worry, as many people on the right of politics are nowadays, hang on a second, perhaps I'm suddenly going to lose all my power. Perhaps everything is going to change. And so democratic institutions can actually aggravate the difficulty level of building these peaceful, diverse societies. That's the predicament we're in at the moment.
You have some experience of a personal nature with this. You said you were born in Germany. Your parents were from Poland, and you're Jewish. So you felt in Germany that even though you were born there, you were never really part of it.
Yeah, so I experienced two things growing up. One was some amount of anti-Semitism, some amount of name-calling. But I also experienced something rather different, which was a kind of creepy form of philo-Semitism. A lot of Germans who were genuinely shocked by their own country's past, who wanted to prove to me how sorry they were for it and how much they loved me, how well they would treat me because I'm Jewish. And I found that both of those, both the philo-Semitism and the anti-Semitism, made it harder for me to actually feel like a true equal in that society. And so I worry that nowadays in the United States as well, we need to learn how to treat people with consideration and with thoughtfulness, but without that kind of tokenization, without those kind of forms of sometimes creepy special treatment, which actually are more alienating when they're integrating.
People try, but don't succeed to make you feel at home. Let's apply a little bit of what you said about diversity to the United States. It would appear that white people are threatened because it appears that they might lose what has been historically their majority rule. Whereas, what's the case on the other side? Why isn't it better when we have multiple groups all becoming equal to one another?
Well, so, you know, I think that this moment is really pessimistic about the question of whether diverse societies are succeeding for sort of interesting reasons, right? So I think a lot of people think it should be really easy to build these diverse societies. How hard is it not to hate your neighbor? How hard is it not to be intolerant? How hard is it not to be a bigot? But then as a result, they actually become really downcast about the current state of our society because they look at the injustices and the discrimination that undoubtedly exists and say, there must just be something uniquely terrible about us, but we're not capable of abstaining from these really base prejudices. Now, for my book, I did a lot of research on the history of diverse societies, which have often gone wrong in really violent and cruel ways. I also looked in quite a lot of detail at human psychology and the deep tendency of human beings to form groups at the drop of a hat and then to go on to discriminate in favor of the members of the in-group and against the out-group. So actually, I think it is hard to build diverse societies. Now, that might make you more pessimistic, but it makes me more optimistic because by the standards of history, by the standards of many other societies today, by the standards of our own past, we are doing pretty well at treating people as equals and we are doing pretty well at sustaining peaceful diverse democracies. So I think an appreciation of the difficulty of what we're doing at the moment can make us much more optimistic about the extent to which we're succeeding.
A lot of people will argue with you about that, as you recognize in the book, and say that, in fact, even though we claim to be more equal than we have been in the past, in fact, there's still widespread discrimination, still institutional racism that we have not yet overcome, and they see that as a reason for pessimism.
Well, and undoubtedly there is widespread discrimination, and undoubtedly there are some forms of institutional racism. But I am nevertheless surprised by the overlap in the pessimism of the far right and much of the mainstream nowadays. So let me give you an example on that. When you talk about immigration from Central America, for example, people who are coming to our country from Mexico and El Salvador and Guatemala and other countries, you have a pessimism of the far right, which more or less says that Italian immigrants and Irish immigrants succeeded because they were talented and hardworking and they were the right kind of immigrants. And nowadays you have those immigrants from quote-unquote the wrong countries and they're not trying as hard supposedly. Perhaps sometimes it's insinuated they're not as smart. And so therefore they're failing. They're in a bad socioeconomic condition. They're not rising the ranks and so on. Now, a lot of the left and the mainstream reject this attribution of blame. They rightly say that it's racist to insinuate that people coming here from Central America are somehow less than. But then we go on to have our own kind of pessimism, which is that, yes, it is true that people from those countries are not integrating very quickly. Yes, it is true that it is said that they're much poorer, that they're really excluded from society. And why is that? Because of the racism, because of the discrimination in the heart of our society. So I looked at a bunch of studies at the best empirical evidence we have in order to figure out whether that pessimism was right. And I was actually surprised by how optimistic the picture which emerged was. So there's lots of studies on this, but according to the most thorough study, for example, which looked at over 1 million data points by four economists at Princeton and Stanford and elsewhere, they found that immigrants today from Mexico and El Salvador, as well as from Zimbabwe and Vietnam and lots of other countries in the world, are making socioeconomic progress at about the same speed as Italian and Irish immigrants did a century ago. It's often a slow process, especially in the first generation, among the people who didn't have many educational opportunities where they're coming from and may come to this country as adults and may have trouble fully learning the language. But the children, the grandchildren, actually have a higher likelihood of social mobility than the children and grandchildren of similarly situated descendants of non-immigrants. That should make us really sanguine. It means that the right is wrong to insinuate that these people are somehow less talented than Italian or Irish immigrants were a century ago. But it also means that many of my friends who say we're not giving them a chance to succeed, they can't possibly make it, are thankfully also wrong, because they are making it.
What about the issue of color?
This is an interesting test case. So again, obviously there is discrimination. We know that. There's interesting studies which show that, when you send CVs to big corporations, those which seem to indicate a white applicant are invited to interview more frequently than those who seem to indicate that the applicant is black or perhaps Latino. So there are some forms of discrimination which exist and which we have to fight against. But clearly, the impediment is not so strong that people aren't making very significant socioeconomic progress in reality. And I think these studies on immigrants are a great example of that. The argument that Irish and Italian immigrants could succeed because they're white, but today's immigrants just cannot succeed because they're non-white, is contradicted by the fact that despite real impediments, today's non-white immigrants, in fact, are succeeding.
You argue at great length that it is human nature for people to split into groups, that there is a tribalizing instinct and that we're all subject to it. On the other hand, you say, as you just have, that groups can, in fact, get along. But you also argue against the idea and say it's, in fact, the most dangerous idea we have, that demography is destiny, that somehow if we allow all these different groups to get together, we can have a better society. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so, one of the really fascinating things about the research on group psychology is how easily we can form groups. Henry Teufel, a really influential social psychologist, got a bunch of kids into the lab and asked them to estimate the number of dots on a simple scatter plot. And so some said 120 and some said 180. And then he said, all right, I'll split you into groups of underestimators and overestimators. And it turns out that the underestimators were willing to discriminate against the overestimators and vice versa. My own students who I teach, who think of themselves as the most tolerant human beings in the world, and in many ways are an incredibly tolerant generation, are willing to discriminate against each other on the basis of whether or not they think that a hot dog is a sandwich when I set it up in the right way in my lecture course.
As trivial as you can get.
Yes. So we can form groups along any kind of line. Now, often historically, the most powerful conflicts in society have been between different religious groups, between different ethnic groups. But that is not a foregone conclusion. And so today in politics in America, there's this idea that Democrats are going to keep gaining an advantage because the groups that have historically voted more for Democrats, Latinos and African Americans and Asian Americans, are growing as a share of the American population, whereas white voters who currently vote for the Republican Party in greater numbers are shrinking as a portion of the American population. Now, I call this in the book the most dangerous idea in American politics because it drives the panic about demography on the right. It drives people like the Trump advisor Michael Anton, who say that the quote-unquote ceaseless importation of third world foreigners, end quote, is somehow going to doom the country and make sure that the Democrats win every election. But it also drives a dangerous triumphalism on the left, which says, hey, we just have to wait for the demographic dividend to fall into our lap. We don't have to persuade people. We don't have to worry about how we actually communicate with a country. We just need to mobilize our own voter groups, and sooner or later, we're sure to have this natural majority. Actually, politics does not reflect that. In 2020, the only reason why Donald Trump was competitive in the election was that he gained his share of a vote, increased his share of a vote among virtually every non-white voter group, among African-Americans and Asian-Americans and Latinos. And the only reason why Joe Biden is the legitimately elected 46th president of the United States is that he got a much higher share of a white vote than Hillary Clinton had 4 years ago. So, you know, the idea that in 2045, whites will predominantly vote for the Republican Party and non-whites will predominantly vote for the Democratic Party and therefore Democrats will always win is really dystopian. It's a possible outcome, but it's a society in which we're going to be deeply and dangerously divided. And by the way, it's a society in which I can walk down the street and guess who you're voting for by the color of your skin. So that's not a goal we should have, even though it is a scenario we should fear.
Just as a side of point, you make a case with regard to Brazil, or excuse me, you report statistics about Brazil showing that a color there, distinction about color, is true within families, that even though people are in the same family, they are seen differently because of the color of their skin?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things when you look at different countries is that, you know, America has a very particular kind of scheme of racial classification. We basically still operate under the scheme of racial classification that slavery introduced to the country, where one drop of non-white skin makes you, according to projections of the United States Census Bureau, a member of people of color who are then sort of assumed to be in some kind of essential cultural and political conflict with quote-unquote whites. In other parts of the world, the way that you think about race is very different. So in Brazil, it really is more about appearance than it is about heritage. And so if it so happens that one sibling has lighter skin than the other sibling, they might be thought to be members of different racial groups. Now, look, in certain respects, the historical use of a one-drop rule continues to shape American social reality. A lot of African-Americans think of themselves as black as long as they have some black ancestors because of that. But to impose that on every aspect of American society and to assume, for example, that somebody who has three white grandparents and one Chinese grandparent is somehow a person of color, and that means they have virtually indistinguishable experiences or views or opinions about the world as somebody whose ancestors have all been enslaved for a very long time, who've lived under the particular form of extreme discrimination that African Americans have suffered in this country for centuries, is just conceals as much about our social reality as it reveals.
Let me ask you about Make America Great Again. Why is it so appealing to people on the right to think that things must have been better before, therefore we should go back to what we were?
Well, one of the things about nostalgia and politics is that, you know, for most people, things were better 25 years ago than they're now because, you know, they were younger 25 years ago and had more hair and, you know, fewer obligations. So there's always a certain kind of nostalgia that is selling in politics. But the particular form of nostalgia that Donald Trump engages in is tempting because it offers a solution to the real challenges of the Great Experiment. It's a false solution. It's a simplistic one. It's one where he's saying, we'll just turn back the clock and somehow the country will either miraculously become more white than it is now, or at least the right group is going to be in charge again and you don't have to worry. But I think that solution becomes more appealing to voters. It has a greater ability to convince people if we're not capable of putting forward an optimistic countervision. And that's why it's so important, I think, that in my book, In the Great Experiment, I try to put forward the vision of a society in which most people, whichever group they're a part of, would actually be excited to live in. Because unless we have that, it is people like Donald Trump or it's people like Marine Le Pen in France who are going to win a lot of elections and be able to undermine our democratic institutions in very worrying ways.
He doesn't have to win elections, but Vladimir Putin also talks about the past as if it was, in fact, a romantically perfect time.
So you know, it's always easiest to rally around you know, the defense of some imagined idealized past. You know, this is a theme that we often see in politics, and the best response to it is to have a convincing and realistic vision of a better future.
Well, once again, you're talking about a great experiment here and moving into places where we haven't been before. And one of the ways you do that is to talk about various images that have been used for America, the melting pot after World War II, the salad bowl, I'll sum it differently when we became more fragmented as we are now. You want a new vision, a new idea, and you call it the public park. Describe why that's applicable.
Yeah, so I think one important question is just, what should our society look like? How should we live together? And historically, there's been these two metaphors for that, which I think are quite misleading. So one is a melting pot, which basically says that, you know, the resulting American culture might bear the influence of various immigrant groups, but all of us will be basically identical to each other. We'll all melt into this new reality. And that, I think, is just unrealistic about how much people value their own separateness, value the groups in which they grow up, value the religious worship they have. And so it asks too much of people. It asks them to give up too much of their cultural heritage. Now, in counter-reaction, there's been the second kind of ideal, which is that of a salad bowl or of a mosaic, which basically says, you know, America is just going to be a sort of group of groups or an association of associations. We're just going to have these communities live next to each other, but really don't engage with each other at all, but don't allow the members to have contact with each other in a meaningful way. And that, I think, is also dangerous, because then you quickly get into deep cultural fragmentation and an inability to have solidarity with each other and an inability to avoid conflict and sustain some commonality of spirit. And so I try to suggest this third metaphor, that of a public park, because in a public park, you and I can go and hang out and just stay amongst ourselves, but we might also run into some other people and make new friendships and start to have contacts beyond our group. And people have both rights, right? As a member of a free society that's very diverse, you can say, I want to stay my whole life within my group, and that's perfectly legitimate. But we also need some people to go beyond that. We also want a society in which there's some real contact, some real friendship, perhaps also some relationships beyond those kind of boundaries. Otherwise, we should worry about our fragmentation. And I think the metaphor of a park expresses that nicely. We would rather be in a park where people are able to make contact with each other, where there's a little bit of give and take, than in one which we just sort of pass each other like ships in the night.
You say that we really need to embrace patriotism. Are you talking about flags and marches in the streets and that sort of thing? Or what do you mean by patriotism? And particularly when, as you indicated before, those on the liberal side say that this country was racist in the past and has always will be.
Well, look, I'm a German Jew, so I'm well aware of historical injustice. And you know, patriotism did not come naturally to me in that context. But for two reasons, I've started to think that it's really important to embrace some notion of patriotism. One is the recognition, when you look at Ukraine at the moment, for example, that it can be a very noble sentiment, that it can be a sentiment which inspires millions of people to risk their lives to defend the homeland. George Orwell, during World War II, said that if a British intelligentsia had managed to destroy British patriotism as it tried to do, the SS would now be marching in the streets of London. The second point is that when you look at the politics of the last 20 or so years, it was the return and the revenge of the extreme nationalists. It was the victory of everybody from Narendra Modi in India to Donald Trump in the United States. And part of the reason for that is that they were often able to monopolize the symbols of a nation for themselves. Because a lot of good, sensible, progressive thinking people were afraid of a nation, they left its powerful symbolism to the worst kinds of people. So I think of patriotism now as a kind of half-domesticated animal. It's always going to remain a little bit dangerous. We should always worry about its negative sides. But we can make it useful for ourselves. We can put it to use in order to build connections beyond the ethnic and religious tribes that otherwise define our society.
What else do we need to have a successful, diverse democracy?
Well, there's important background conditions. So, if people have a feeling that they're not getting ahead socioeconomically, if they think that, they're being fired from a job or a company going bankrupt away from being in real penury, if they feel that the social and cultural institutions of a country really aren't responding to them, really don't listen to them, perhaps disdain them, then we're also going to be less likely to respect and tolerate the neighbor with whom we might have some important disagreements. So we need the political background conditions to soften the conflicts. And that is the case when there's rapid economic growth, when there's an inclusive welfare state, which gives benefits and duties to all citizens irrespective of identity group. When we have political institutions that actually respond to people's preferences, when we have a political system in which both parties actually try to appeal to voters of all demographic groups rather than just seeking to build the majorities among the traditional voter groups, all of those background conditions would make it much easier for diverse democracies to succeed.
How important is the rule of law?
Very important. So I have a whole chapter when I talk about the sort of philosophical foundations of how we should have diverse democracies. And I think the state has to guarantee two things at the same time. It has to guarantee the traditional freedom of the individual against the state or against a tyrannical majority. It has to make sure that I can worship in a way that displeases most of my fellow citizens or that I can criticize the president without being afraid of going to jail or being beaten up by some mob. But we also need to free people from what Dan Acemoglu and James Robinson call the cage of norms, which is to say we also have to make sure that your own community, your own priest or imam or rabbi, your own neighbors, don't get to tell you how to live. And that if you want to strike out on your own and pursue a very different kind of style of life than your parents or your community, that too is something you can do. And so we need to rein in the state so that it can't oppress the individual. But we also need the state to interfere when it is those more decentralized kinds of groups which are coercing their own members.
Given what we've seen recently, particularly the January 6th attack and all that was behind it, and the concerns that people have about stability in the United States, how realistic is it to think that we can, in fact, achieve the kind of society that you have outlined as the ideal?
Well, what I'm seeing at the moment is a kind of cultural civil war of the elites, in which everything at the high political level is really screwed up. And obviously the danger of Donald Trump being reelected president in 2024 and stepping up those kind of attacks on democratic institutions is very significant. But we're also seeing a lot of very positive developments in the heart of society. We're seeing real socioeconomic mobility among a lot of immigrants and minority groups as well. We're seeing actually much less segregation. I mean, within my lifetime, I'm 39 years old now, a clear majority of Americans thought that interracial marriage was immoral. Now that figure is down in the single digits. And whereas in the past, 1 in 33 children were mixed race, now it's 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 newborn babies. So we're actually seeing a lot of relatively positive developments in the heart of society. The question is whether our political challenges and the challenges at the elite level are going to screw those up or not. So for me, making diverse societies work is a difficult undertaking. The risks are real. Many diverse societies in the history of the world have failed. But in order to make it work, we don't have to completely reinvent the wheel. We can build on the progress of the last decades. We can double down on our aspiration of building equal, diverse societies. And the question is whether we will succeed in defending that project against the demagogues and the pessimists who now have so much power.
It appears that Joe Biden has very low ratings, favorability ratings at this point, although he seems to be doing all right with regard to the war in Ukraine. But other than that, he's not. There's a thought that the Republicans will take over the Congress in this next election and that there's a real possibility that Donald Trump might run again. How pessimistic do those things make you?
So my last book, The People vs. Democracy, was all about the threat the populists pose to our democratic institutions. I think we got pretty lucky in terms of our institutions surviving the first assault on them by Donald Trump. He has learned since. He has assembled a team of much deeper loyalists. He's learned how to use the lever of power. And so we may not be quite as lucky the next time around. So I very much worry for 2024 and for 2028. I very much worry for the populist assault on democratic institutions. But all of that is a reason to develop a vision of a society that most people actually would want to live in. Because you can't beat pessimism with pessimism. You can't beat the pessimism of the right, which says that diversity is going to screw up the country, with a pessimism of our own, which says that, you know, our country is so terrible and racist and unjust that we'll never manage to do anything. I think we need to have a vision of society which takes its injustices, which obviously exist, seriously, but is also able to offer an enticing vision of a kind of country that we could build together. And that's the project of my new book, of A Great Experiment.
You are a professor at Johns Hopkins University. What about freedom of speech within academic institutions? Isn't there a conflict going on where a lot of liberals simply don't want to hear conflicting voices?
Yes, there is a little bit of a bubble in our public discourse in which the 5 or 10% of most progressive people, many of whom are my friends and I agree with them on a good number of things, have started to dominate the discourse in certain circles to such an extent that disagreement with them becomes dangerous for people's jobs and reputations. And that is a substantive problem because it means that many voices aren't heard. It is a problem in political terms as well, because it makes it much harder to understand the actual needs and preferences of people. I just read a few days ago an interesting report by Democratic strategy groups about Latinos who are starting to vote for the Republican Party in greater and greater numbers. So anybody who wants to avoid Donald Trump being reelected in 2024 needs to think very hard about how to build democratic support among that voter group. But what the report did was simply to claim that the reason for Hispanics' voting behavior was racialized misinformation, and that we should now start to engage with this voter group in a culturally authentic way, while calling them Latinx. So basically, this boils down to saying anybody who votes for the Republican Party is a racist. And by the way, we're going to communicate with this group in a language, in a lingo like Latinx, which is very, very popular among a set of progressive activists, but which we know from polls, 98% of Hispanics do not like. And so that's an example of where we can either continue to use the term that is approved by a small group of people, or we can try to actually engage with Hispanic voters in a culturally authentic way. But that means we have to tolerate some dissent and we have to listen to them and we have to realize that their ideas may not be what the preconceptions are. That's a really important decision because the re-election of somebody like Donald Trump may hinge on it.
I think the way you describe it suggests that you really think that in order to maintain liberal democracies, which you think, in fact, we should do, it's going to be very challenging and very difficult. And so that's why you call your book The Great Experiment. We haven't gotten there yet.
No, I absolutely agree. In the history of the world, many diverse societies have gone very badly wrong. When they fall apart, as they often do, you have war and genocide, you have terrible injustice, terrible forms of oppression, and nothing rules out that we might not fall back into that. But that's all the more reason to be optimistic about the current state of our society, which is much better than most of those diverse societies in the history of the world, to be angry and energized about fighting the injustices that still exist in our society, but also to recognize and grateful for some of the progress we've made in the past decades. And it's a reason to remember a fundamental truth about politics, which is that the very best you can achieve in politics is always limited. If you think of the most wonderful society that exists today, that has existed any time in the past, it's going to have deep injustices and deep flaws. But the very worst that can happen in politics is unmitigated evil. When you think of what life is like right now in parts of Ukraine as the country is under assault from Russia, when you think of what life is like right now in places like North Korea and elsewhere, it is just a complete disaster. And so the stakes of building diverse societies are high. We have to fight against injustices in our midst. But we should also recognize the achievements of our own society, and we should vow to build on them rather than to discard them.
What should we learn from places like Brazil and Hungary, which are democratic, but which have, as did Germany in the 30s, elected people who turn in to be tyrannical?
In many of these countries, there are leaders that have been democratically elected, but once they were in power, they started to transform the political system in such a way that it became incredibly hard to remove them from office by democratic means, because they consolidated the hold of the media landscape, because they abolished independent institutions, because they put their own loyalists in control of the electoral commission and all kinds of other key institutions we need to keep a democracy running. And so what this teaches us is the brittleness of democracies, how easily people who disdain the most fundamental norms can weaken it when they get into power. So Donald Trump didn't quite manage to do to the United States what Viktor Orban managed to do to Hungary, but he may succeed the next time around. That makes it really, really urgent to ensure he doesn't get an opportunity to do so.
Well, so thank you very much. The book, again, is called The Great Experiment, Why Diverse Democracies Fall Apart and How They Can Endure. Love the book. Love talking to you. You're a very interesting person. And I know our audience will feel the same way. Thank you very much, Yasha Monk, for being with us.
Thank you so much, Warren.
The producer of To The Point is Andrea Brody, with assistance from Anna Buss. Our engineer is John Meek, assisted this week by Katie Gilchrist. Now it's your turn. If you like To The Point podcast and you want to hear more, leave a review. You can do that wherever you get your podcast, or my Twitter handle is WarrenOlney1. Thanks for being with us this time, and join us again.